chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Tehillim because they are connected. But that's safe to say that the first chapter starts with Ashrei, and the second chapter ends in Ashrei. So they say it's one connection, these two chapters, okay? The question that we're asking is this, is that if you look through all of Tehillim, of the Psalms, you will find that there is prayer, deals with prayer, different requests that God, that King David has of God, and two, it deals with sciences, okay? We'll discuss why sciences later. But the fact is that these two chapters deal with something that really belongs in Mishlei. I mean, it deals with the righteous. The first chapter deals with the doings of the righteous. And the second chapter, I mean, it deals with the evil people, good and evil. It's not a prayer. It's not about science. It's not. The question is, why is it here? And what are these two chapters doing here? What is the subject of these two chapters? And what are they doing here?
I think.
Thank God.
In the Mishlei, we are dealing with the consequences of people's actions, what they do to each other when they do not follow the rule, what an evil person does to himself or to the people around him as a consequence according to the rules of the universe. Causes have effects. What we're dealing with here is the result of immoral actions in terms of direct acts by God against the evildoer.
I would just like to add one thing to all this, okay? I'd just like to add, it's a very good thing. It's a very good explanation. I'd like to add one thing, and that is this. Mishlei also deals with a private person that's developing, it's just a beginner, that's developing in the world of Torah. And they had to deal with his life and had to deal with his personality. Tehillim is dealing with, there's a certain level where a person becomes a tzaddik. A tzaddik is a person that has developed his personality, and now he's doing actions in such a way that he's relating to God. There are two problems with the tzaddik. One problem with the tzaddik is that he goes out against the wicked. He does actions, and he works for the contrary to the way the wicked would work. And to his very personality is a sense. A sense in his personality, in the way he lives his life, in the way he operates, that he is very different, and he awakens in them certain guilt and certain responsibilities, and which he sees from in the verse themselves, that in these wicked people. And therefore, it would be impossible for the righteous person to really exist among all the evil people. He would be destroyed in the world of evil. There's so much evil, and the people hate the righteous. I'm talking about not only non-Jews, but Jews themselves. There are many Jews in really an honest, righteous person, people get very upset with them. Okay? Even though they might be doing very well in the community and doing the good for the community, but they cannot tolerate the person. Okay? And therefore, the only way, since there is so much evil and they could pull them down, one person, and they could pull them down, so therefore that person can only exist with God's stuff or God's intervention. And therefore, once you're dealing with that level, then you need God's personal relationship to protect you against the evil that is there at the time. So the first chapter is talking about the difference between the tzaddik and the wicked, the tzaddik and the rasha, the difference between the two. And the second one is talking about anti-Semitism, but it's more than anti-Semitism, it's a hatred against the Russians, the righteous themselves. Okay? The question is that if we're talking about that the wicked go out against the tzaddik, then the question is why in chapter 2, verse 2, it says that they counsel against God and his anointed. Okay? So the question is that they seem to be going against God. The answer is that the person that represent, especially in this case with King David, it was well known that the Navi, actually the prophet Samuel actually came and anointed him as king with a public thing, and that it was in the name of God. Some people say this was during the time of the Philistines when they first attacked, when he was anointed, and that they knew it from God, so it was an act against God, okay? But in general, the righteous person, when it says God, when the righteous person operates, people recognize that he's operating on different principles, you see? And these principles are reality, and people sense that there's something beyond, that he is telling them what they should be doing based on truth and reality. And because of that, since they're not doing it, they feel a strong sense of guilt. And since they feel a strong sense of guilt, so they have to hate him. But they sense that this is what they should be doing. Okay? And especially his actions also, the way he acts for justice, and you see that it's not for himself. It's not selfishness, but for the public, and he operates for the general public, and he tries to do justice. They see that it's something very, very different than anybody else, and therefore that's why they hate him. That they recognize that he's connected to truth, reality, and God. I don't think the question is why would they hate God? Everybody understands why he hates the righteous. Why do they hate God? The answer is God is the source of reality. You can't hate reality. You just can't hate reality. I mean, that's impossible. So therefore, you deny reality. You deny reality, and you hate the person that awakens what you should do in reality. You understand? You cannot hate reality, okay? You deny reality. But then if there's anybody that, let's say, what kind of parent tells you what you should do, you get angry at your parents, or anybody tells you what you should do, you get angry. You know it's the right thing, but you get angry with them. Why are you angry? Because you're trying to deny reality and they're not letting you. So you hate them because they're not allowing you to deny reality. So you figure if you get rid of them, then you can deny reality. This is not a conscious thing, but it's an unconscious thing that's going on, but it's a hate. So therefore, unconsciously, they're against God, but they can't hate him. They just try to deny him, and then they hate the tzaddik. Once you reach the level of a tzaddik, it becomes impossible to exist in the physical world because of all the people that are out to get you. And the only way you could exist at that point is with God's acceptance, God's will. The question is like this. The question is that, let's say for a person is a tzaddik, and he's just a tzaddik to himself. In other words, like, he doesn't get involved in the world, okay? The answer is like this. You look at the book of Judges, the second book in the early prophets. It says there that there were two judges, and basically it says that they had a personal life, but they took care of their family, and they said, other judges, they went out to war, and other judges, they did other things, different types of things that this judge has been doing. The answer is that if you're not, if there's certain times nothing bad has happened, or there's nothing that you feel it's your responsibility, okay? But as soon as something occurs in the physical world that you take as your responsibility, like let's say, for instance, in your personal life, if somebody steals from you, you take it personally. You have to do something about it. You have to protect yourself. The tzaddik will feel that way if a certain injustice is done to a person that can't protect himself. The tzaddik will feel the same way in that situation. He feels an obligation to go out and protect the person that cannot take care of himself. So therefore, since he does that, he immediately awakens the anger, and since he's always, and he speaks up, and he says his mind, so then immediately he gets the hatred of the wicked people, and the people that are trying to just, live their lives without justice.
The question is if a tzaddik, basically a tzaddik has learned through mishlei, and he learns how to make plans and strategies, and he, even when he's doing righteousness, he can't do it like a crazy person. He must do it like an intelligent person. An intelligent person is going to have a plan and work out a plan to be successful. Okay? But however, okay, so the question is, why does he need God? It should be still in the laws of nature. Okay? The answer is that the type of strategy that he is planning, he is going, and the type of situation that he's going to get involved in is going to awaken the hatred of people. People do not like a righteous person because he represents a lifestyle that they're trying to deny. Okay? And therefore, the type of things that he gets involved in, nobody gets involved in. Like most people say, it's not my business. The tzaddik decides what his responsibility is, what area of responsibility is, and where he speaks up, and where he talks, and where he gets involved. And because of that, he's going to awaken the anger of the wicked. And there is no way, and the wicked could use methods that he can't use because he's righteous even when he's fighting the wicked. And therefore, to a certain extent, he will fail in his endeavors because it's just too much. It's beyond a human being to make it. Even with all the planning, which he must do. He can't just do it like a madman. He has to do it with plans and training. But however, the enemies will be too great, and he will not be able to stand up against the evil, and therefore he must turn and rely on God for his success, and that is the book of Tehillim. The question is, should he try to help the evil person, to help the evil person maybe to change and to correct them? Yeah, there are certain situations where you can. In other words, you have to know when and where. So, I mean, simultaneously that you try to educate him, you have to also defend yourself. You have to know the situation. But that would take a certain amount of thought to recognize how to do it, whether you should do it, and whether now is the time to protect yourself. It's different situations, and the tzaddik will have to decide what to do in each and every situation. All right, the question is, would it be his responsibility to get involved in something dangerous? Well, the fact is that Rabbi Akiva studied Torah when his life was in danger. I mean, his life was in danger. He died because of it. He learned Torah when there was a decree by the government that you should not. I mean, Mordechai stood up against Haman, who was the second in command, and he stood up against them. There are, yes, you have to put your life in danger, even though you don't know if God is going to help you, but you have to go out and do justice and then pray to God to help you. Okay, the question is that isn't it possible that if a person could crack under this pressure, okay,
In other words, when he's doing justice, the person could crack under the pressure. Okay? There are two types of means to justice. There's two ways to justice. One is a person feels a sense of justice, a feeling. And it's an emotional feeling that he should go out and fight for something. That type of person could break down. But a person that has developed this personality based on ideas of truth, there are people that, even not in Torah, that stood up to societies. I mean, you see Socrates and different thinkers stood up for justice in certain cases where they felt was right, and they stood up and they didn't break down. And definitely, in Torah, you definitely have people that saw the truth and they stood up, and no matter what the consequences, they were able to stand up to it. And so therefore, they're able to stand up. So if you come through justice through a feeling that I have to do justice, be very careful, because under strong pressure, you can break. If you come to justice through the world of ideas, through the world of thought and understanding, and you see your whole personality changes based on these ideas, then the odds are you will not break down. Unless you have a weakness someplace, then you could. But the only thing is the change of personality based on ideas strengthen the character to become very strong, that you could stand up for justice against all odds. But however, you realize the reality that the odds are too great for you to be successful, so therefore you must turn to God in times of trouble. The question is, what about a person that's not righteous? He hasn't reached that level. He's studying, he hasn't reached the level. What should he do? The answer is, the best way of doing it is that you must develop, to become a righteous person, you have to develop two things. Your way of thinking, okay, and your honesty, that's part of thought, the honesty. And two, the other thing is your emotions. You must perfect your emotions. So therefore, the beginner must start with two things. One is Talmud, the study of Talmud, which is, Maimonides says, it's the best training for the mind. And two, he should deal with the subject of Musar, which is like the Mishlei, which is an introduction to your personality. Mishlei will also help train your mind, too. It was written in such a way that it could train your mind. Okay? So, therefore, you would start with those two things to develop your personality. Then afterwards, you get involved in Tillim to start becoming more in line with God, and also to come more in line in the world of justice and kindness, to start dealing and working with people in these ways, so that as you develop, you start seeing what your responsibility is. It must come through knowledge and understanding a certain development. A certain amount of justice and kindness will come through the law, through the system of law of Torah. So therefore, you will gain from that. As you live the life of Torah, you learn from, you see there, there's charity and there's justice. I mean, there's all, the whole system is there. But then there's a development of the mind and the personality where you start living that way. And once that happens, then you're naturally going to do this. And then as you start doing this, you start seeing the anger that turns against you. So then you must turn to God. In other words, it's a development of your personality, and there's an order to the development of your personality. There is your mind and your emotions. You must develop both. And as you develop both, then you will start guiding yourself by God. And as you relate to God, you will get the ideas of justice, and you'll start knowing that you have to do justice, and then you will recognize that you need help from God. Then you'll turn to God. And that gives us the general view of the whole chapter, and now we'd like to go verse by verse. And the first verse says, Asha Yisha Shalom Holach Lachas Rishon. Fortunate or happy or praiseworthy is the man that does not go with the advice of the wicked, and the ways of the sinners he does not stand, and in the ways of the sinner he does not stand, and he does not sit with the mockers, or he does not sit with the scorners, and he does not sit with scorners. So that's the, he has three types of wicked people. In Hebrew, we have the Rasha, the Choteh, and the Moshe Leitzim. With the Rasha, he says the advice of the wicked. That's all he says. The sinners, the Chatam, he says, in the ways of the sinner. And the Leitz, the one that scorns or mocks, he is Moshe Leitzim. He's like the best, those people that just sit around and, you know, that sit around and just talk, you know what I mean? We'll have to define, with the little information that he gives, we must define the three types of evil people. Once again, the Rasha gives advice, the Choteh, you go in the way of the Choteh, and the Moshe Leitz is a person that sits around and score a cynic, yeah, something like a cynic, but we'll have to define the three a little better.
Yeah.
The first one that gives advice, you see, there are two components to a person. There's one person that he must have a goal, he's goal-oriented, or he has an objective, he wants to be successful, he's working towards something. Like, for instance, the evil people that leaders like Hitler and Stalin, I mean, they want the power, they go after power. Well, people that go after money where nothing will stop them, they have their goal. These are the Rishon. They don't think about anything but their goal. That's advice. Advice represents that they think it through. They work it out, and they think it through, and they have a plan, and they're going to carry out that plan. The way of the Choteh is just you just go wherever you feel. That is the person, the pleasure thinker, the pleasure seeker. You know what I mean? Like a person that just, like it was like Elvis Presley, they say that that one time he was in the mood for a certain type of pizza. So he took out his plane, took the people that were with him, he went cross country to this place where he was in the mood for this pizza. You see, that is a pure pleasure. If he was in the mood to, let's say, to go roller skating, he would just rent the whole rink and he would just go in there, you know what I mean? He was interested in pleasure, like a Pharaoh. Also, he just enjoyed, just did whatever he felt like. The opposite of the Rasha. The Rasha is a person that wants success, he's goal-oriented, and nobody's going to stand in the way. Okay? So that takes care of the first two. Either person is guided by that he has a goal, and nothing, doesn't matter how he gets to that goal, nobody can stand in his way. Or he's just a pleasure seeker. He just enjoys life, and wherever his emotions take him, he goes at that moment. Okay, but he's guided by pleasure. The third person is a person that's not involved in any of these two things. They just sit around, like they sit around the coffee houses, and they talk about all the wrong ways that the government is running, and they talk about people that are doing stupid things, you know. Basically, a life of lust and hara, but that's the essence of their life. They just sit around, and they make decisions. They could be thinkers. They could be like pseudo-intellectuals, you know what I mean?
Crack-a-barrel philosophy,
that's right. But they could be thinkers. I'm not talking about dopes. They could be real. They could have a good mind. But the whole purpose is not to get involved. That's why it's a mockery. They make a mockery of life. You see, that's what a cynic is. That's why he says they're mock or scorn. What they do is they take life and they say, see, the first two are involved. They're trying to make a life for themselves. What they think is correct, they're involved. The third one pulls out of life and he looks at everybody else and he comes up with his philosophies that they don't know what they're doing. If I was there, boy, I would really know the right thing. I would be doing the right thing. This president doesn't know what he's talking about. I know what's right, and I would run the government better. You think that is the most of late, okay? Now, James, insofar as your question is that it, could it only be this one? Could there be a mixture of the different, or each person could only be one? The answer is the three that we're talking about is the person that makes decisions to live their life a certain way. It's their total life. It's the essence of their life. Like the businessman, the essence of his life is making money. The man for power is that he's driven by that. The pleasure person, the examples that we gave is totally pleasure. And the spawner is the most of life is a person that also sits around and does nothing. But however, then there's what we would call mediocrity. And that is the person that, you know, he has a goal, but he'll also have his pleasures. He doesn't go completely for the goal. Like he's, most of the time these people are caught up by not from within, they're not driven from within, but their evil is that they're caught up and they follow society. They want a little bit of power, they want a little bit of money, they want a little bit of pleasure, they like to talk against other people and look down about people. They want, they're just basically a slave to society. So that's the type of person that would have a mixture. He might have one or two, he would have two or three of these things, some type of mixture of these type of things, but he's pulled in by the society. He does not go against his the society. The three that we're talking about will act differently than society, very different. They put all their life and all their energy into the area of life that they've made a decision to live. That's the difference. But they're both not living in line with it. Or whether you take only one of these, that's the extreme Russia, the extreme wicked person, or whether it's a mixture where he's just basically caught up in society and he can't move in any one direction, basically they are, they're all wicked. And they're going in towards their basic emotional needs, whether their needs is to make a decision about their own life or whether the decision is to be guided by society. They are still guided by their instincts and their desires and their emotions, and that is what is evil. James, what you're saying is what the Radak says, and the Radak says that people start off with basically a human being starts off with the basic pleasures of life. The desires, the basic infantile desires that a person has. Now, how we develop, I mean, each person, these three that is mentioned here individually, not if they're components, they have made decisions to go all the way in a certain direction and to devote their life to that direction of life. Okay? But however, there are people that just live, they're caught up and they don't change and they can't make a decision to go in which way to go, and they're basically caught up by the society. Dagobert says, but his desire is in the Torah of Hashem, and in his Torah he should meditate day and night. Okay? So he says, in other words, that in Torah he should put... Okay, the question is like this. Since a person, in the last chapter we're saying, he should take away all his energy, his psychic energy, and his physical energy, from the pleasures of the physical. The question is, where should he put it? What should he do with it? What should he do with this energy? Where should he put this energy? The answer is he should put it in the Torah of God, and in his Torah, he should study day and night. Okay? Okay. That's where he should put his energy. Now, Rashi quotes our sages as saying, Rashi says that the second half it says that in his Torah, it says a pronoun. It doesn't say who we're talking about. So Rashi says we're talking about a person, a person's Torah. What does it mean? It means that when you start out studying Torah, it's not you, it's not your personality. So you are accepting God's Torah, and you see it clearly with your mind, And you see it clear, the mind sees it clear, but it's not part of your personality. At a certain point, it becomes second nature, and it becomes part of your personality. So that is a development. We were also talking before about the development. That's the way the righteous develop. They study Torah, and they recognize that it's in their mind. They see it clear, but it's not their personality anymore. Still not their personality. Their personality still pulls them the other way. But there's a certain level where the Torah is your personality. There's the Torah itself. It's Torah. Becomes the person's Torah, which is the total personality. In other words, the first verse is saying that you should not live a certain type of life. Now, once you don't have energy in that type of life, what do you do with the energy? You can't sit around and do nothing. And it will not, if you do not do something positive, you can't live a life that I'm not going to do this. That can't be your life. That's an impossibility. The verse can only tell one component at a time. I can't tell the whole picture at once. It must talk about one component at a time. Now, the total person must have two things. It must make sure it doesn't live one type of life, but it lives another type of life. You cannot have a complete life just in the first verse. That's an impossibility. That's just not doing anything. I'm not doing anything. You must have something positive. When you must replace what you are undoing in the way you live your life, you must replace it. You do not replace it, then it's just going to go back to, you're just going to remain one of these people. One of the people of the first chapter. What we would ask you, what is a perfected person? Okay? We want to know what is a perfected person. So we will look for the state of the soul. What the soul is. What the nature of the soul is, right? Okay? And here it says, you should put all your energy into the study of Torah. Right? Okay? Now, the thing is that what the verse is saying, what this verse is saying, is that part of the status of perfection is the activity of learning. You must have the activity of study of Torah. If you do not have the activity of study of Torah, then you do not have a perfected soul. The perfected soul demands the activity. See, most people, when they look for the soul, they say, "Who are you?" Now, that is part of our definition also. We have different qualities of the soul that, well, we just said that that becomes part of your nature. But also, there is a continuously going on of activity that is also part of the status of your perfection, and that is as much as possible. I mean, you're involved in eat, you have to eat, you have to sleep, and since you're a person of justice, you do justice, but that is also all part of Torah. But there must be an ongoing activity of the study of Torah. See, he says you must be involved. It's not a matter that I study Torah, now I'm a righteous person. You cannot be a righteous, you cannot stay a perfected soul without the study of Torah. A perfected soul can only come about that is part of the definition of the perfected soul, that he has the activity of learning. The question is, how much did you study? Okay, the answer is that it depends on your nature. Some people could learn 2 hours a day and then they can't sit anymore. Some people could sit 18 hours a day. So they're both doing the activity of learning based on their nature. Can't go more than who you are. And also, let's say a person is starting out late in life and he doesn't know Hebrew, he doesn't know. So he could, there are books written in English, I mean, there are tapes today. I mean, if you get involved on your level, and in your way, what your needs are, an involvement in the landing of Sarah. So there's different levels and there's different ways and there's different situations. But part of the, but you must be involved in the study of Torah, each according to their level, their situation, and their needs. They must be involved in the activity of studying Torah, and that is part of the definition of the perfected soul. The question was that Shirley asked is that what is it that says first you shouldn't go, then you shouldn't stand, and then you shouldn't sit? So Rashi separates the three. He says first there's a pattern in which you attach yourself to a wicked person. First you walk by where they go. You understand? And you just see them acting, you see? But you walk by, you go down that street, and you're furious, you know, you just keep walking by, but you see the evil person, and of course, since you have natural emotions, you're furious because of your emotions. There's an identification, right? If you do that, then you're going to come and stand by it. You're going to stand longer to watch and to maybe even say hello to them. You see? And then suddenly you'll be sitting with them together. In other words, since nobody starts out evil, I mean, you're not born, you're just drawn to the physical, but there is a development to do worse. In other words, there's a metaphor, like, for instance, you cannot have an empty land. You cannot have empty. Either you're going to plant. You don't plant, you're going to have weeds. I mean, it just doesn't stay empty. Same thing with the human being. If a human being cannot just stay, he's not static. He's dynamic. He's constantly changing, developing. And therefore, if you don't stop and immediately undo that draw towards evil, and that's a natural thing because, like we said before, everybody is born, you know, their attachment to the physical. So therefore, if they don't watch it, then they first take a one step, then a second step, then a third step, until they're part of the group. They're part of the inner group. So the thing is that you must stop that development immediately. And that's what Rashi says, why they have that order of the verses. Just a quick review of what we did last week. What we said last week is the first two chapters of the Psalms are connected. The first one is the individual righteous person, and the second chapter deals with the nation as a whole. Okay? And because of the hatred that people have for the righteous and for the nation of Israel, so therefore we need a special God's help. We need God's help in those situations. So the thing is therefore the Book of Psalms deals with the righteous person and his prayers and how he turns to God for help against the wicked or different situations in the physical because of his righteousness. Okay? All right. Also last week we did verse 1 and 2. In verse 2, we mentioned, since we're talking about the nature of the righteous, the first step in the nature of the righteous and what is his perfection is that he is involved in learning. He's involved in the study of Torah. Constantly involved. That's part of his nature. That's part of his perfection. In other words, usually when you talk about perfection, and that we'll soon see in the third verse, when we talk about the nature of perfection, you talk about about who he is, what he is. See, that's the next verse that shows what you get from the learning. But however, part of the perfection, part of his nature, is his involvement in the world of study. Okay? Now, the thing is I would like to just at this point quote our sages to show you the level of hatred. Okay? It says like this. This is in the Book of Tzachim. It's page Daf Memtes and second side on the days. Okay? And it says like this. It says that Reb Chiya stated that anybody who's involved or studying the Torah before a Amoritz, an Amoritz is an ignorant person, it's as if he cohabited with his betrothed in his presence. It's as if the wise person cohabited with the betrothed of the ignorant person in front of him. Okay? That is the hatred that an ignorant person has for a wise person. Okay? And we have to analyze where does this hatred come from, and and what level of hatred it is. Just clarification. It's saying that an ignorant person hates, cannot tolerate a wise person. They hate him. Okay?
Yeah.
And it says that if a wise person would study in front of an ignorant person, the ignorant person at that moment has such hatred for the wise person that it's as if the wise person cohabited with the betrothed of the ignorant person in the presence of the ignorant person. Here you see the greatness of our sages, and that in just a few words, the ideas that are expressed in these few words is amazing. Okay, we'll soon see in a minute. The first thing is that when he sees, in other words, let's put this in terms of learning. In other words, he feels he cannot have learning. The ignorant person feels he cannot have this thing, what the wise person has. In other words, whenever you feel you can't have something, you know what I mean, the desire for it becomes very great. You cannot have this. Okay? The second thing is he wants it. This is something he really wants, so it's even worse. In other words, sometimes there's something you don't really want, but you see somebody who has it, you're just jealous of him. You just want it because he has it. But here, the hatred and anger is even more so, because he wants this, which the wise person has, and he can't have it. He wants it and he can't have it. Those are two qualities that bring on a very high level of hatred. But there's even one more, which is even worse. And it says that he did this act in his presence. In other words, that he totally has no regard for him at all. In other words, if you're doing a bad act to another person, so you might hide it. You don't show it. But if you have no regard, you go right to his face, and you do right to his face. You have no regard for him. You see, the ignorant person senses that the wise person has no regard for him. And he senses that. So when he learns right in front of him, when he's sitting and learning there, so the ignorant person feels a total disregard, like he doesn't even care about him, he doesn't even care about this, what the ignorant person feels or thinks. Like he doesn't care about him, like a nothing. Like he doesn't think about him. That is the hatred that the ignorant person has for the wise. The word engaged, there's a difference between betrothed and engaged. Engaged is a social term that, that we get engaged. If we want to get unengaged, we just pack up and leave. Yeah. Betrothed is a level, right, it's a level of legality. that there's an attachment here. There's stronger attachment and a higher level of an engagement, the legal level. And so therefore they're that close, and he wants to be with her. And he can't have her, and he has her. He has something that he wants, and he can never get it. And he has no regard. He does this act right in front of him. That is the level and the reason also for the hatred that the ignorant person feels about the wise person. The ignorant person wants to have that knowledge. He wants the knowledge. He wants the knowledge of the... he wants to be considered a wise... Everybody wants, recognizes that to be considered a wise person is something special. He wants to be that, but he feels he can never be that. He feels he can never get it. Really, it's he himself that stops himself. If he wants to sit down and study, he just sits down. Most people, yeah, but he can't do it. But he can't do it. He can't bring himself. Something stops him from doing it. And then the third thing, he senses that the wise person has no regard for him at all, you see. So therefore, that's a terrible degradation. So there's jealousy, there's you want something that you can't have, and there's like a feeling of degradation that these people that you want, these very people look down on you. That's a terrible, terrible hatred. That is a hatred that the ignorant have for the wise. Now, the reason why I brought this in, okay, this whole idea, is because it's that, because that we gave an introduction. Towards the end of hatred, that the righteous have to protect themselves. So therefore, I'm trying to show you that the evil person, and this would be an evil person, this ignorant person, but an ignorant sometimes just means ignorance of truth. They don't see the value of the life of truth. And so these three evil people that we mentioned at the beginning of the chapter, the first verse in the chapter of Psalms, has a hatred. We're trying to show that he has a hatred for the very knowledge of Torah. And this we see throughout the world. The philosophers were hated for their knowledge. Books were burnt, I mean, by the ignorant, because they hated their books represented this knowledge. You see the hatred that they have for knowledge. They just burn books. They destroy people just because they're intelligent people. The ignorant always hated the thinker in every society. So therefore, we're just explaining one aspect of this hatred, and it's based on the learning and knowledge of the chacham, or the wise person, and that's the hatred that the evil person has against the wise. Therefore, at a certain point, the righteous person, because of that, he would not make it in the physical world. And because of that, I mean, all the hatred of all the people, you see how many people hate that books and ideas and truth, how much they hate it. So you see that they need special protection from God, or not they wouldn't make it. And therefore, that's the book of Psalms. Verse 3 says like this. Now, as a result of his learning, he will be like a tree planted on the edge of water. In other words, at the edge of a brook, running water.
planted by the edge of running water. That its fruits, this tree, its fruits are given in its time. Its leaves do not wither. And everything that he does, he is successful. Okay? So this metaphor is the result of the life of learning. When you become so attached to the life of learning, there's a few things that happen and it become part of your nature. Okay? Like we said before, there's two parts to the definition of what's a perfected human being in Torah. One is the activity of learning, but the activity of learning affects us, and this is the way that it will affect us. Okay? Now, when it is planted, now my interpretation is going to be based on different commentaries, so I'm not going to quote every commentary, but it's based on different commentaries that I brought together. Okay? Anyway, the first quality is that the righteous is like a tree planted by running water, okay, or the edge of water, okay? The question is, what is this quality? The question is, does verse 3 have a show up from a blessing of God? It seems to follow from the second verse. Second verse is it talks about your involvement in the world of study. That is part and parcel of your perfection, the desire and involvement in study. Okay? But as a result of this involvement in study, you will get the qualities of verse 3. And the first quality that verse 3 talks about is that it is like a tree planted on the edge of water. There are two qualities that you get to the tree that is by the side of a running brook. There are two qualities which are very close. One is he's independent. He doesn't need help from an outside source. His source of nourishment is always there. He's independent. Two is he's always satisfied. I mean, sometimes he has more, sometimes he has less, whatever, but he's always satisfied. That sort of represents a certain satisfaction that he's satisfied with his life the way it is. Okay? So the thing is that it shows independence and satisfaction. Usually an independent person, not all the time, but usually does have, is usually satisfied and accepts his life the way he is. But anyway, it's two separate qualities. Let's not connect it, okay? Two separate qualities. One is independent, one is satisfaction. Now, I think you recognize that an independent person, people don't like. People don't like for two reasons. Certain people are part of society, like they're part of society. Anybody that's out of the society acts different than the society they can't stand. So an independent person, or a person that's always satisfied, people can't stand. It bothers them that they, you know, everybody is unhappy. Now why should he be so happy? Or independent, people can't stand that. And also, a person that's a wicked person can't tolerate anybody that goes against his way. You see, a wicked person is not caught up by the society. He makes his decisions within himself and according to his personality, but however, he can't tolerate if somebody differs from him. It bothers him. Somebody differs from him. Somebody's different. So therefore, the people, that's another quality which the people sense, which is distasteful and hateful to the other, to the wicked people about the tzaddik, about the righteous person. That he's an independent, he makes decisions based on his mind, and it doesn't matter to him how, he makes decisions based on his mind and not the way the public does things. And two is he's always satisfied. He's a happy person. He's happy with his life, and he's satisfied with his life. People sense this, and this bothers them. This is another reason the hatred of the righteous. Is the first quality, okay? The second quality is, and it gives its fruit in its time, okay? In other words, at a specific time, it gives its fruit. The Sephorno says about that, that it's as if the tree decides its future exactly when it's going to give off the fruit. In other words, the righteous controls his life totally through plans and strategy, depending on the situation. Everything is guided through wisdom, and he even can predict to a certain extent the exact time when things are going to happen. Okay? If you find by a righteous person that it doesn't work out exactly, it's because of one of two things. Either the laws of nature, which is out of his control and out of his knowledge, that he could not make a decision on. I mean, let's say you're crossing the street and a drunk driver is driving, or you're walking on the sidewalk and a drunk driver is going 80 miles an hour and drives on the sidewalk. There is nothing you could do about it. It's out of your hands. That's the type of situation that you have to rely on God, because there's no way you could plan for that. So it's either people or events or situations in the physical world where the righteous person has no way of knowing of and planning out that particular factor. Let's say the wicked are making a plan to destroy him in hiding in private. They have a secret meeting. There's no way he could protect himself from that. Once he has the fact, then everything is worked out according to the situation in the best possible way. And everything is worked out as if everything is planned and guided by his knowledge and his decision. You see? But the only thing is, the only time when you do see a failure is at where it's totally out of his control. Okay? Here also, I mean, because of his knowledge, when people see his ability to make decisions and his insight in different things, when they speak to him, there's a certain amount from the wise person, they like to listen to him because they learn from him. But the wicked people and the ignorant people, when they hear this, they have to feel jealous and anger towards them, because of the same reason they would like to have such a thing and they can't have it, right? So therefore, you find the hatred in this situation when they see this type of wisdom in the mind of the righteous. The third quality is that the leaves don't wither, okay? And now, according to the Sephorno, the leaves represent that the physical body decays, but the mind doesn't. In fact, the mind strengthens as you develop it, and it has nothing to do with the physical decay. I mean, Stephen Hawking, I mean, his body is like he could, I mean, he can't do anything with his body. Even his talking has to be made through a special machine. But yet his mind is as quick as a, he's Stephen Hawking. I mean, I don't have to explain who he is. So the thing is that you see that the mind is separate and developed separate from the body. And when in old age the person or if a person's body is starting to decay, And the evil person sees the mind in such, like he's still doing that enjoyment, that ideas, he recognizes that there's something about the mind that is above anything he could do. So he recognizes that the mind is totally separated and above the physical world, and it's beyond his world. You see? So, the thing is that's also a cause for the hatred of the evil people. Okay, and the last quality that the righteous has is that anything he does is he's successful. And the Ibn Ezra says that in his personal life, since what we said before, he works everything out with a plan and strategy, barring outside that's out of his control that he can't plan on, he will be successful with wealth, children, and honor. He will be successful in all areas of his life. Where he wants to be successful, you understand, where he feels the need to be successful, I mean, there he will be successful. With the raising of children, he wants wealth, so he'll be successful there. So the righteous person is very successful because of his method of planning and strategy. He's successful in all areas of life, and definitely the wicked would be jealous of that. As a result of these two verses that King David said, is you see really every aspect, and I'm sure as you see the details of the different aspects that we spoke about, the hatred that the wicked, the ignorant are by definition evil because they don't have knowledge. So therefore they're going to hate the righteous in a very, very strong manner. And we saw the different areas of hatred that is going to feel. And therefore, because of that, the at that point, when you reach the level of a tzaddik, at that point, then because of all the hatred from all the different people, and from the different nations that they hate. I mean, you see that there were nations that hated thinkers, philosophers that stood up for their philosophy, and they were killed by nations. You see, it is impossible for the righteous to exist on their own. They would never exist if it was not for God's intervention, and where you need help from God. It is that point when you reach personally. We said the first chapter is on the individual level. On the individual level, when you reach that level of righteousness, of all the qualities that we just mentioned, then you will have the hatred of the multitude of people, multitude of evil people, and therefore you must have protection from God to protect you. There are two types of nations. There's one nation that's guided by wisdom. Then the hatred of that nation would be the same as the individual tzaddik. But there is one nation that by definition has anti-Semitism, and that is the nation of Israel. Because we represent God, and how we in particular represent God and why people hate us in particular, that we'll discuss in chapter 2 when we get to the nation of Israel. But another nation that is, let's say there was a nation that lived a life of righteousness and justice. And there was, there seems to be a few nations that they did operate that way. Then if the other nations sensed that, they would have the same hatred, you understand, as the hatred that they have for an individual righteous person. But the nation of Israel is slightly different, and we will see that in the second chapter. The question is the ignorant person, why does he have this hatred for the righteous? Okay? Now, what we're saying is that, first of all, this hatred of the righteous cannot be in a situation, let's say, for instance, Africa 100, 300 years ago. Seems to be that they didn't know any righteous people. They would not have this conflict. They would just live the life of an ignorant person. But they wouldn't have the conflict because they didn't see a person living according to reality. So this conflict can only be when you're in the presence of a righteous person. So an ignorant person that's closer to the righteous have a much greater hatred than it is further away. In fact, the sages state, I just read it today, I don't remember where, but it says basically that the hatred that a Jew has for a wise person is greater than the nations that they hate Israel. Because the thing is, they're close because of their closeness and proximity to the righteous. So that, and they also, because they live in the world like a thinking world, the Torah world, so they know what they're supposed to be, you see? So therefore, that becomes a terrible threat when this person lives the life of Torah. But however, the non-Jew that lives in a different country or doesn't understand, so then he might hate the Jew for whatever reasons that we'll discuss in the next chapter, but however, not to the extent that the ignorant person of Israel hates the righteous of Israel. We're up to verse 4. It says, not so the wicked. They are like the chaff that the wind drives away. Okay? Now, chaff, the question is, what quality of chaff are we talking about that the wind drives away? Chaff, let's ask the question, does chaff have any benefit? All right, very good. Chaff has a benefit for the wheat, but it doesn't have any benefit once the wheat is ripe, then you just get rid of the chaff, and it just blows away in the wind. That's the way they used to get rid of the chaff. They used to throw up the wheat, and the chaff would naturally fall away, because the wheat doesn't need it anymore. The wind blows it away. Okay? What the metaphor is... Thresh it, right. But it's very light, and it's blown easily by the wind. That's what it means. Once it's separated from the wheat, it's blown easily by the wind. It's blown away by the wind very easily. Right? The thing is that there are two things that the human being has. The human being has the body, the physical body, the physical self, and the soul. Okay? Now, the body is the body without the soul. In other words, by the soul I mean without a life of Torah, without a life of learning, a life of ideas. Without that, then the person by nature, you see, let's put it this way, all animals, all their instincts will preserve them, either individually or as a species, but their instincts are in line to benefit the species. The human, their emotions and their instincts, if left by to its own devices, will harm and destroy the human. Okay? So, and also other humans, because if you can destroy yourself, usually you will affect others. Okay? So therefore, they're saying the body, the chaff, when it's separated from the wheat, where it doesn't have the essence of the human being, namely his mind, his thoughts, the Torah life, the Torah thoughts, where he does not have this, you see, then he is in the hands of everything around him. He's not under his own control anymore, but he's in the control of outside factors beyond his control, and therefore be just moved around like the wind blows the chaff. Therefore, the verse started, not so the wicked. In other words, all the benefits that we spoke about last week, I'll give just one example, because you can go back to all the examples that we spoke on last week. Like, for instance, we said that the thinker is independent. Now, even a person that is a king, his glory, if he's not involved in it honestly, it's only for his own glory, then he needs people. If he was put on an island and says, here, there's nobody here but the king of the island, that would not satisfy him. He needs to rule over people. He needs people. He's not independent. That's what it means, not so. Not so means is if you go through all the qualities that we said last week, each one individually, you will see that every wicked person cannot have it. You cannot have it without thought. And without the Torah thought, you will not have it. Pasuk verse 5 says, therefore the wicked cannot stand in just judgment, and sinners in the congregation of the righteous. And verse 6 says, why is this so? Why is this true? Because God knows the ways of the righteous, and the way of the wicked will be lost. Verse 5 is talking about there is a certain time where the judgment day comes. Judgment day, when God judges. We're not dealing now with laws of consequences, laws of nature where you get consequences. We're talking about where God intervenes in the laws of nature, and there's sometimes a judgment. Well, they can't stand in judgment. And all these people cannot be in the congregation of the righteous. And the congregation of the righteous means that they will not have God's supervision. In other words, when they're talking about, and that's why I read verse 6. It says, because. What does it mean you can't stand in the congregation of the righteous? Because God knows the ways of the tzaddik. What does it mean he knows? What does it mean God knows? I mean, of course God knows. It means that he relates to them and he protects them. But the ways of the wicked, toved, are lost, like passive. In other words, their very nature is they're self-destroyed. In other words, many times, it doesn't mean that God doesn't, because it says, verse 5 says that they will not be able to stand up in judgment, meaning that God will harm them. But over here also it says a lot of them God does not have to harm, because the way they live their life, they will destroy themselves. So in two ways the wicked are destroyed. One way, sometimes God doesn't have to intervene. He allows the laws of nature to come through. Every once in a while, you know, a wicked person somehow manages to escape. He slips through the cracks, so God wants to destroy him a little bit earlier than the laws of nature would affect him. So therefore, God would intervene and destroy them for whatever reason. Okay? But however, the righteous, God definitely knows the righteous, and he protects the righteous. And this goes back to our original introduction, where we said that the purpose of Tehillim is because the righteous will have many enemies. And here you see that it's the battle between the enemies of the righteous, and that he needs the protection. Couldn't make it in this world without God's protection, the way the world is set up. In other words, the nature of the wicked are that their actions are self-destructive. That you would get a lot from Mishlei, from Proverbs, where it shows you how they destroy themselves. But sometimes God wants to prevent them from doing certain harm, or they've gone so far that the nation should be destroyed in itself. So therefore, God will actually intervene in that nation and destroy the nation, like you see by Sodom and Amorah, and you also see by Nineveh, by the story of Jonah, that God wanted to destroy them if they don't repent. So you see that God does go out and destroy wicked people. From whatever I've read in Torah, when God intervenes in the wicked, it is usually national. I don't know if God intervenes in the wicked for the individual. That I'm not sure. Right, the question is, in verse 6, it says that God knows the ways of the righteous. And what does it mean he knows the ways of the righteous? What ways does he know? Okay, he knows the righteous are people that stand up for justice and truth. Okay? And therefore, they're going to evoke or awaken the anger of the wicked people, and they won't have a chance to stand up to them. And so therefore God knows this, and therefore God goes out to protect them against the wicked. Okay, it says, why do the nations gather? And also the second word is nations, also talk in vain, or talk nothingness. Okay? Okay, verse 2 says, the kings of the earth stand, and the princes conspire secretly against Hashem and against his anointed. Now the commentaries say, both Rashi and the Radak say, and I think the Ibn Ezra also says it, that this is talking about when King David was first anointed as king over all. He was first king over two tribes or 2.5 tribes, and then later he became king over all of Israel. And when he became king of all of Israel, the Philistines decided to go against them. This is in Rashi quotes Samuel, the second book of Samuel, chapter 5. Okay? So when they heard that he was anointed that he was anointed of all of Israel, so they went out to war against him, and King David asked God if he should go, and God said he should go, he will win. And King David went out, and he destroyed them. Okay, and he won the war. Okay, and on this he's saying, why do they gather together against God and against his anointed? Right. The question is, if they knew. And they all say, the commentaries say, that the nations knew that God anointed King David, right? And if God anointed King David, and the nations knew that God anointed him, I mean, they have to be crazy to go out and go to war against God. How are you going to go out and go to war against God? It doesn't make sense at all. Doug wants to say that it is possible that they knew that Israel had a god, and their god anointed their king, the king of Israel, King David. But however, the Philistines had their own god, and their own god, and since they had their own god, so they felt their god could maybe win over the god of Israel. That's what Doug wants to answer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. However, there's an interesting verse that one time my son Shmuley pointed out in Jeremiah, verse 6 and 7. It says like this. 6 says like this. There is none like you, O Hashem. You are great, and your name is great in might. Verse 7. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For kingship befits you. For among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, it is known that there is none like you. Chapter 10, verse 6 and 7, and especially verse 7. Okay? I mean, it says openly that there is none like you, and all the kings know it. All the people know it. Well, this is a well-known thing. Now, so therefore, how do you explain that they worship gods altogether? How do you explain that they worship any god? How do you explain that everybody doesn't accept God from the words of Jeremiah? Everybody should accept the true God. How is it possible that they accept false gods?
It says why.
The question is, it says wise people. There are many wise people. I mean, people that are scientists and great thinkers, and they don't accept God. And they definitely don't accept the God of Israel, you know what I mean? Like, even if they did accept God, I mean, they don't accept our definition of God, our idea of God. I mean, they don't accept the true God. Now, if that is true, then what is there? Now, according to this, it should be everybody accepts them. And where's the facts here? What's happening? The answer is there is two ways of gaining information. Or, in other words, information about reality or about the world. One way is you have to study. You have to gain knowledge to see this. There's certain knowledge that everybody has, but however they cover it up, they don't want to see it, that every human being has. Okay? Like, for instance, it says here that one of the commentaries says that what was the... What did it mean, the people of the nations speak nothingness? One of the commentaries says that when they went out to war, they bolstered their ego by saying, look, we won over Saul, it was a mighty victory, and there was a powerful, we could do it again. But everybody knows that in every given situation, there's a different situation. Not all the facts are the same. You have to know it's a lot based on strategy. Maybe they have a different strategy. Maybe they have a new weapon. Maybe they have a new this. Even without God, I mean, there's always... In other words, whenever you say two situations are the same, you have to stop and think about it. In other words, saying two situations are the same is one as you go through all the qualities and every component and say, yeah, they're equal. So it should come out the same. The results should come out the same. Like a scientific test. They test all the exact... They keep everything exactly the same. But in everyday life, not everything is exactly the same. Okay. So the thing is that there's many things. So therefore, they should know, any human being, in any sense, should know that, well, there's a different war, and we have to prepare a little. Maybe we have to prepare differently. We have to think it through again. But they felt secure that they did it once, they could do it again. That was a false security, you see? Anybody can know that. Anybody has to realize that, you know, whenever you come into another situation. But the emotions don't want to let them see it. They don't want to see certain areas of reality. Sometimes when you're angry, you feel something about a certain person. The anger goes away, you think they're wonderful. You understand what happened? You see, the emotions blind you to certain truths. Okay? Now, the simple order in the world makes you say there must be a God. There has to be a God. Okay? And that is so simple that every human being sees. Any human being could see that, especially the wise people. They definitely see order. I mean, through their studies of the sciences. And why don't they see God? Is because there's something that they don't want to accept God about. They don't want to accept something about God. There's something about God that goes against their nature, and they don't want to accept that. And so therefore, they deny it. To them, they would have to find what is stopping them. What emotion is stopping them from finding God? When they undo that emotion, or at least recognize that they have it, that will be, even just recognition, even if they don't undo it, recognition of an emotion that's affecting you will help you see through and be able to deal with reality. So again, there's two types of ways of finding truth and reality. One is you have to study with the mind to find the truth. There's certain truths that are so obvious all around us, it's impossible not to see it. The only reason why we don't see it is because we don't want to see it. There's many truths like that. And the book of Mishlei deals with a lot of everyday life situations where it is where people close off different areas, then they're going to fail. Like consequences, everybody should know that if you do an act, there are certain results from that act, and people don't think about the consequences of their act; they just do it on the immediate, not the consequences. The consequences sometimes you have to think through. But the thing is that the idea of consequences, I think that's a simple thing, you see? And that people should start thinking through, but it's the emotions that don't let them think that way. One second. The question is what is the quality, what is the component that stops a person from accepting the true God? That will be verse 3 in the Psalms. We'll get to that in this chapter. Verse 3 of this chapter, which is the next verse. When we get to it, we will discuss what is the thing that stops them from accepting God. Once again, there are two ways of gaining knowledge, truth, reality, and that is one is through knowledge, through the mind, through study, through actual study and investigation.
Right.
The second way is removing the emotions, that which there's like a certain curtain or a veil over the eyes. Now, well, it's not really over the eyes, it's over the mind from seeing reality, because there's a part of you that does not want to see this truth and reality. There's an emotion or an instinct which is very much against this idea, and therefore denies the truth and reality. If you remove the veil, it would be very obvious to every human being what the reality is. Now, we're saying that about God, too, that there is that truth that you must remove the veil, and if you remove that veil, you will find God. And even though, and here in this particular case, they knew that God anointed David, and yet they were able to deny it. Emotions are very, very powerful, and they can deny any type of truth. It can close off any type of truth that you have, and therefore, sometimes things that are so obvious. Sometimes you see a person that misses something, you say, "How could he miss it? He has to know it." The answer is, he can miss it because he knows it, but he closes it off. He blinds himself to the fact. And there are many cases like that. Okay, verse 3 says, "Let us cut their cords and let us cast off their ropes from ourselves." Okay? Now, the translation is not exact. The first one is not. Okay, they translate it. Let us cut their knots and cast off their ropes from ourselves. Okay, and these terms are used. This is what the other nations are saying. This is what the Philistines are saying. Okay, the Philistines deny that they knew that God anointed King David as king. And yet, somehow they still go out to fight him, and they go out against God. How can it's impossible? Okay, but we said there is an unconscious thing. Now the question is, what stops them? All right, so we have to interpret this this metaphor. The thing is that an animal, there are two things. When you put a yoke or a rein on him to control him, there are two things. There's a knot which controls the way the head moves. Then there's a rope to guide the movement. Okay? Now, the thing is we know the mind, there is either rational, either you have every step or you're missing a step. You cannot move the head. In other words, rationale, an idea is either true or not. There's no medium. There's no movement. Either you have every step, you have every question answered, or you don't. There's something missing. You see, there's no movement there. The actions, there are different movements. So therefore, it's a rope which controls you. It controls you to a certain extent, but it allows you to operate. Okay? That's the rope that when you're plowing the land, you have the knot and the yoke that keeps the yoke in place that he could go, you see, to keep him straight. And then the bar, the movement, he has a rope which is slightly loose that gives him a little movement, which are actions. Okay? Now, the thing is that what the people recognize is that if you accept religion, religion demands responsibility. You see? There's certain people, there are two extreme emotions. There's an emotion for religion and there's anti-religion. Okay? Now, the emotion for religion, okay, usually is a religion that fits into your emotion. Okay? The anti-religion don't want any restraints at all. They want a total freedom. Judaism, on the other hand, doesn't fit into either extreme. Judaism is based on the mind, you see. The mind, you must be guided by the mind. You must train the mind. Now, people, the way the human being is created, he starts out purely emotional and instinctual, which means he's born with an animalistic part, has the ability to be trained. That training controls him. Now, what happens is that you go to one side or the other. Either you live a controlled life or an uncontrolled life. Like we went through the different types of wicked people. Okay? So the thing is that we're saying that you cannot follow any area of your emotions or instincts. It's okay to have emotions and instincts as a result. But to make decisions what's real and what's not real is must be made by an exact type of thinking. And two, not only that, not only must you train the mind to find truth, but you must uncover that the how the instincts stop you from or cause you to do things. So you should be aware to uncover that veil. You must uncover the veil which covers you from seeing the truth. That is the process of, especially when you first start out, is a very difficult and painful process. You have to go against everything you know. Sometimes you come to a thought that says you should control yourself more than you were trained. Sometimes you come to an idea that says you should have more freedom than you had. You see? So therefore, the mind, but the mind, you see, has nothing to do with how you were trained, very little. The mind must start from basic foundation and start thinking, and you must undo the veil which covers those other truths. That is a very difficult, that the emotions turn away from. That's why you see so few people that are real thinkers. People turn away from that type of thinking, you see? And that is what they deny. See, that's why they had to deny Judaism, because Judaism demands a life of thought, a life of ideas, and a life of undoing the veil, the emotions and instincts that stop you from thinking clearly.